Fascinating. Todd Murphy with us. We'll take your phone calls as we talk about sacred pathways, the brain's role in religious and mystic experiences. We'll get more into that, too, when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. Todd Murphy with us. We'll get to your calls in just a moment. Todd, your subtitle, of course, of the book, The Brain's Role in Religious and Mystic Experiences, fascinates me in that I would conclude just by reading that, that without the brain, you don't have the religious or mystic experiences. But that's not the case, is it?
I do believe that religious and mystic experiences appear from certain patterns of brain activity. But if I may beg your patience just a little bit,
sure.
I had almost gotten to kind of the punchline before we went to the break.
Review it just a little bit.
Okay, so we have two senses of self on the left and the right side of the brain. The one on the right thinks without words. And when the two fall out of phase, we can experience non-physical beings, and in an extreme manifestation of the phenomena, it can be God. So what we're doing when we pray is unlocking, tapping our own right hemispheric intelligence, including our intuition, our ability to make associations between things that usually don't seem connected. So when we pray, we're actually appealing to our own sense, our own wisdom, that we can't access with words. It's another way of thinking, and we have to stop using words to achieve that kind of thinking. And one of the things that can help us do that is to focus on a presence outside ourselves. So when we imagine we're praying to a God that exists outside of ourselves, we're accessing part of ourselves. Like many Hindus and Buddhists, I believe that God is a manifestation of the self. Om Tat Sat, as they say in Sanskrit, thou art that. So prayer is a great thing. And now let's proceed.
Okay, so the subtitle, The Brain's Role in Religious and Mystic Experience. Let's take the brain out of it. Are you saying we're not going to have that experience?
Without a brain?
Without a brain.
I believe that without
consciousness, something out there.
Well, without a brain, I don't believe that we could experience anything at all.
Uh-huh. So what happens when we die?
What happens? Well, one possibility is that everything that happens when we die, including the content of the death process, which we see in near-death experiences, that it's all going on in the brain, very quietly, deep in the brain, where it often cannot be measured. Although I recall a couple of years ago, some Dutch researchers found a burst of activity from the brains of rats as they died. Another possibility is that when we die, we actually go out of our bodies, and we have subtle bodies, including subtle arms and legs and so forth. And if we can have a subtle arm when we're out of the body, why can't we have a subtle brain? And then all the processes that happen in the brain continue to be available to the being that has left its body. Now, this, of course, is farther from science than I like to get. So I believe it's happening in the brain as a scientist. But being outside of a body usually means having a subtle body, and that would mean you could have a subtle brain. And all the things that are represented in the brain remain available to our consciousness, so that when we're out of our bodies, we can have memories. And we know what parts of the brain are involved in memories, the hippocampus and the parahippocampal gyrus, the entorhinal cortex, and other such fancy names. But there's no reason that these have to stop existing if we're out of our bodies. And there's a good reason not to build a scientific hypothesis on it, because that's one that the scientific community would reject, but that doesn't mean it's impossible.
Hmm. You also are a believer in psychic skills.
I am indeed. And let me add one further remark. Never mind. Yes, I believe in psychic skills. First of all, I've had a number of experiences in my own life that are most efficiently regarded as psychic experiences. But more importantly, there's been some research in Dr. Persinger's laboratory. One experiment in particular is the most telling. And in this experiment, two subjects were both given the same kind of brain stimulation, what Dr. Persinger calls circumcerebral, meaning around the head. My own edition of this technology at spiritualbrain.com is called the Shiva Neural Stimulation System. And there are some illustrations on that website, on the website, that will help people to understand it. But one of the two were both receiving the same kind of stimulation. One of them was getting an EEG monitoring, so their brain waves were being recorded. The other was sitting in a room with a flashing light. And when the first one looked at the flashing light, the EEG of the second demonstrated it. And what this is I believe it's a landmark experiment, because it demonstrates communication between two brains under certain conditions. And even the tarot card carrying, crystal bearing, crystal wearing psychic, who does psychic work for a living, will acknowledge that there are times when psychic work is harder. It does take certain conditions. If they're standing at the corner of a busy street in a signal in a city surrounded by noise and hundreds of people walking by, that's a hard time to do it. If they're sitting quietly with a candle and their tarot cards and the person they're doing the reading for is sitting in front of them in a calm, quiet environment, that's a good condition in which to do it. So there were a number of other experiments that are laid out on one page at spiritualbrain.com, but together what they indicate is that it is possible for information to be transmitted between two brains. Now, if you go back early enough in our evolutionary history that we don't have language yet, then this kind of communication would confer tremendous advantages to the people who have it. Someone thinks of something, and you receive it just as though they had spoken to you.
I know,
so that amazing. Together you can act in concert. And there are many people who believe that social animals, wolf packs, horses, groups of horses, I forget what the word is, but herds of horses out in the wild, mm-hmm. that they communicate
they
with one another without words through a kind of telepathic communication. There are also subtle cues, like the way they breathe and the way they move and, their body language, so to speak, that can add to it. But there are many people who believe that the core of all communication between animals is psychic. And I've seen one or two things in my life that persuade me that this is quite possible.
All right, let's go to the phones. They're stacking up here for you, Todd. We'll go to Anthony in Philadelphia to get things started on our wild card line. Anthony, good morning.
Yes, good morning. Yeah, I have a question. If during the last conversation, the gentleman said that if reincarnation does exist, which means he questions it, well, how can you explain? Here goes a few examples. How can you explain the person who was clinically dead, no brain activity, no heart, nothing, for up to 2 hours, some people up to 2 hours, some people 1 hour, is able to recount the whole conversation word to word from word to word that was taking place way down the hall in another room,
yep.
Who was standing where, who was saying what, who was wearing what, or how can you explain the four-year-old that was able to recount his entire experience being a pilot in World War II, mm-hmm. the name of his wife, the name of his children, the plane he was actually flying in, or how can you explain a person that was able to recount their life in the past life?
Well, Todd,
he's
a believer in reincarnation, so I don't
yes.
think there's any argument there. Go
I
ahead.
Believe in reincarnation. I believe in reincarnation. I believe in reincarnation. Let me be emphatic about that. As far as these kinds of experiences in near-death studies are concerned, you haven't even touched. You're only at the tip of the iceberg. PMH Atwater, who is a longtime near-death experience researcher, has a case on record of a Soviet official before the fall of the Berlin Wall, before Gorbachev, who died away from Moscow, and there were in Georgia, and they were concerned that there would be allegations of foul play. So they put his body in deep freeze to ship him back to Moscow. After they thawed him out, he resuscitated. He was completely frozen, and still he resuscitated.
Almost like cryogenics.
That's right. So what I now, as far as absolute brain death is concerned, very, very few researchers have even tried to find out whether or not the brain is truly silent when a person is dead. With EEG, all you can see is about the outer centimeter and a half. So you don't know whether or not deep in the brain it's happening quietly. So what I would add to something like that is that it's possible for the capacity for human brains to be in direct communication with each other to be vastly disinhibited. All the controls, all the stops removed from it, so that while they are clinically flatlined, they have what we would call in ordinary language, not scientific language, they have awe-inspiring psychic skills, and they can read the brains of everyone, including the people down the hall, and recount all kinds of things, perhaps even pick up the content of their mind so accurately that they see what the other person is seeing.
Speaking of freezing, the wood frog, Todd, has the ability in the winter to freeze itself. It totally frozen, yet it stays alive. It goes into this deep hibernation. The heart stops, mm-hmm. and then when it thaws, it's alive again.
Yes, indeed, which says that you don't need much activity in order to keep a frog or a person alive. It's just got to be activity in exactly the right area of the brain. And it doesn't have to be robust activity. It can be very quiet. With one little blip every hour is enough for the organism to know that it remains alive.
Let's go to Huntington Beach, California. Cheryl's with us on the Wild Card Line. Hi, Cheryl. Thanks for calling.
Okay, thank you for taking my call again. Thank you for all the prayers for my brother, Al, who has the cancer and was in the Navy as well. And thank you for serving.
Oh, you're welcome.
I really appreciate that. I would just like to say that I was at the hospital in Newport Beach this last week with my brother. And the chemo was doing very, very well with him. And I stood out on the balcony and I was, asking God for prayer. And 2 days later, he's on the Huntington Beach Pier, and he trips on this plank was like a quarter of an inch above where it was supposed to be. And he tripped, caught it just right, and fell and broke his arm on the same side that he has the chemo and the cancer. And he's doing so very well. And the police came and he took pictures and, they took him back to the hospital and what have you. But what my question is, and his attitude is so positive, and he's such a strong person for being as old as he is. He's a lot older than me. But what my question was for this gentleman is, do you think that the positive attitude heals people within themselves, or do you think it's God that heals them?
Well, I think that the processes in our minds and in our brains that we experience as God do indeed have the capacity to heal people. But I think thinking positive is actually less important in the healing process than not thinking negatively. But it's almost impossible for a human brain, a human mind, to be neutral and have no positive expectation and no negative fears. The only way to chase out the negativity that truly corrupts us, and many, many studies on stress and its effect on the body have shown this, is to keep that positive attitude. So the important thing for someone who is sick, like your brother, may he heal thoroughly, completely, and may he heal quickly, is to maintain a positive attitude, because that's the only way to keep the negative stuff out. A person who expects to die has an awful lot easier chance of going unexpectedly than a person who is convinced they're going to live and does everything they can to keep themselves alive in every way as they are dying. I once worked in a nursing home, and there were lots of patients Some of them lay in their bed all the time doing nothing, and others were working and reading. They were on TV. They watched television and argued with the people on TV. And those people did extremely well.
They were alive.
Yes, there was one fellow by the name of Mr. Beveridge. Any liquid refreshment, he told me as he introduced himself. And he was 99 years old. And one day when I was in there to mop his floor, I was younger and doing that kind of work. He said, I asked him once, you know, you're very old. You're not going to be here long. I was the janitor. I was the only one who could talk this way.
Yeah.
To be blunt, you're going to die soon. So what are you living for now? Tell me, when I'm 99, what is there to live for? And he says, well, what I really want is to be 100. I want to have my 100th birthday. I want to have lived a full century. Great. Well,
that's
I was working.
Cool.
I was working there when he hit his 100th birthday, and he was very pleased to make it, but he died 3 days later. At the end of his 100th...
He did what he wanted to do.
He did what he wanted to do, and then he lost the capacity to anticipate something positive, to engage a positive thought. I will be a centenarian was gone. Nothing came to replace it, and the inner tightness and firmness that it takes to keep an organism alive was gone, and he relaxed into his death, because I mopped his floor on the day that he was 100 years in 1 day and 100 years in 2 days, and he was very quiet and contented and relaxed. He had done it. He had also lived a reasonably good life. He had, you know, he was in World War II and, you know, did good work there in a battlefield. And so forth. So avoiding negativity, I believe, to be more important to the healing process in the psychological component than engaging positivity. But there's no way to do the one without doing the other.
Let's go to Rochester, New York. See if we can squeeze you in real fast, Keith, before the break. Go ahead.
Mr. Murphy, for some of us, this really is an all or nothing world. For all that you are a scientist, you still have this incessant need to feel good about yourself and others, and that right there limits you in what you're able to reach in the scope of yourself. I think quickly what you said about yourself being Irish and Catholic is more to the point. You and I do have common ground. My father is a semi-retired Episcopal priest in Kentucky, so I grew up all my life with that mumbo-jumbo. But in closing, you hold on to things so much. You just went on at large here about someone who's suffering, like the woman's father, whatever, from Huntington Beach. If he was suffering that much, I, Keith, would have put a pillow over his face and smothered him.
No,
I go,
Keith,
I go
you
in
can't
my
do
mind
that.
Where you would never go.
Keith, why would you kill the guy?
Because I'd be giving him peace. All of this, like that lady went out, how he's flourishing. And so if someone isn't hurting that much, you put them out of their misery. Pillow over the face, squish them, and goodbye.
Dr. Kevorkian is in the
Well,
audience.
He started out his remarks by saying that I was holding on to things, including wanting to feel good about myself.
Well, you hold on to that thought, Todd, because we're going to hit the break, and I want you to react to all of that, and we'll take final calls in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. So Keith in Rochester would suffocate the poor guy in distress and smother him. Your reaction, Todd?
Well, I would advise him, first of all, to think carefully before he commits murder. Secondly, he started off his, well, what shall I call them, remarks, by saying that he could see that I was still holding on to feeling good about myself and holding on to feeling good about others. And in that, he was absolutely right. I want to feel good about myself and others.
Nothing wrong with that.
We're a species that does best when we feel good about ourselves and about the people around us. How does a man with low self-esteem sink the spear into the buffalo that feeds his tribe?
You know, when you started doing this years and years ago, have you found yourself changing at all?
Yes, sure.
And I guess that's natural, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Well, for one thing, there's a certain amount of opposition to this whole line of research, primarily directed against Dr. Persinger, but with some backlash directed against me and my work and my technologies. And I find that you know, I don't particularly like that, but at first I thought it was going to be a scientific endeavor and I would do research and come to conclusions and publish things and so on and so forth. But there's more fighting going on, and I've learned to be a warrior, including picking carefully when to defend and when to counterattack and so on and so forth. But it's also made me, more to the point that I think you're driving at, it has made me think very clearly about my spiritual practices, my spiritual life, and made me very aware when I'm not living according to my own principles, my own beliefs, mm-hmm. and so forth. So it has definitely given me more integrity. I see more clearly than before the value of generosity and so forth. I'll reveal one thing to your audience. I was a homeless person for 2.5 years, from when I was 16 to when I was 18. And I now my favorite charity is to give to homeless people. I don't like to see a guy with a battered cardboard sign that says, you know, need help, anything will do, and not give him a couple of dollars.
I'm like you. You know,
if he drinks it, then he drinks it. Because the homeless people who do that, that's all they have. So I'm not going to give him enough to go out and get a fifth of Johnny Walker Black Label and render himself, you know, bring himself to the emergency room. But, you know, here's a couple of bucks. And if you need food, buy food. If it's time for a drink, get a drink.
I was at a red light and there was a homeless person with that cardboard sign on the side of the road a couple lanes over. And so I held up a $5 bill and I said, hey, come on over quick, you know, while I still haven't had a red light. And he said, man, just toss it in the street. I'll go get it. And I said, just throw it in the street? And he said, yeah, I'll pick it up.
Yeah, he would.
So,
sure.
So I dropped it right in the middle of traffic. It's blowing around, but he was over there getting it.
Mm-hmm.
He went and picked it up.
Yes, and he is a homeless person, and they will risk life and limb for $5.
What got them, Todd, in that situation?
Oh, this is a long story, and well off the
And then we'll wrap it up with calls, but it's just fascinating to me.
There are many ways it can happen. Usually, a person is over-optimistic about their chances in a certain situation. They lose their job. They start drinking. They think, well, it'll be all right. I'll fix it tomorrow. I'll fix it tomorrow. I'll fix it tomorrow. The landlord comes. The sheriff comes. They're evicted. They stay with friends for a while. They wear out their welcome, and then there's nowhere left but the street and very few comforts besides besides drinking.
Why don't they just get a job anywhere? Fast food somewhere.
No one will hire a homeless person. No one. The homeless person can't be relied on to get to work on time. They can't be relied on to get to work in clean clothes.
Can't he fake it? Take a shower, put some clothes on?
It's harder to do. You wake up in the morning, you got to get to work, you're homeless, you're hungry, so the first thing to do is panhandle enough money, beg enough money to get some food in your stomach. By then, it's time to move directly to work, and the idea of taking an hour to, you know, go to a laundromat and dry your clothes, you know, wash your clothes and dry them, it just doesn't work. The only way to get people out of homelessness is to create homeless shelters where the way of living has some resemblance to normal living.
Yeah.
And the ordinary things that people take for granted in their homes, like a washing machine or a stove, are available to them.
How many of them, of every 10, and then we'll go to the calls, but of every 10, how many do you think can be reached, changed, turned around?
I would say 6 out of 10.
That's pretty good.
But, you know, for some it takes a huge effort.
Could you literally pick one off the street, get him a shower, get him a shave, put a suit on him, and get him out in society, or would he fail?
It depends on the individual and the extent to which they are afraid of what happens if they fail. If they think, if I fail, all that happens is I go back to sleeping under the bridge and drinking too much, then odds are good that they will end up there. But if they think that it's an absolute catastrophe to fail, because such opportunities come to them very rarely, then they might be able to push themselves and do it. And yes, indeed, they do have to fake it. When I got the job that got me off the streets, I had a friend who had a place, and I put down a phone number that wasn't mine and an address that wasn't mine. And fortuitously, I had changed my clothes that morning So I went in, looked reasonable, filled out the job application, put down an address, put down a phone number, and the man looked at me and said, can you come in at 4 o'clock? And I did. And then when I had the job, I went to another friend and said, I've got a job. Can I stay with you to my first check? And he said, yeah, sure, why not? And so that was rare good luck.
Yeah, it sure was.
But I'm hoping we can get back to some of the material, and here I'm going to do my thing around Sacred Pathways, available in paperback and Kindle edition through spiritualbrain.com. And yes, let's take some calls.
Let's go to Michael in Pensacola, Florida, east of the Rockies. Hey, Michael, go ahead.
Yes, hello. Well, thank you for your very stimulating show every night.
Sure thing.
I hope I can be blunt. I completely disagree with your guest.
You may disagree. We're not here to agree with everything. Go ahead.
Great. What he just said about the homelessness, that was nice. I agree with that. That was made more sense than anything he'd said up to now. What he was espousing mostly was all, I've heard it all before, it's all the same pseudoscience that is not based on any real science. It's all speculation. It's his own theorizing and his own hypothesizing and whatnot. And what I use is the source book is the Bible. The Bible answers the main points about what you're dealing with tonight: the nature of death, the evolution, reincarnation, all of these main issues are pointed out and answered succinctly in the Bible. And this man obviously sounds very confused and very... Well, my question is, I know I can't talk all night, but why do you take such a hodgepodge of beliefs and pick and choose whatever you want to make you feel good and think you're on the path to truth?
Well, I'll let you defend yourself there, Todd. Go ahead.
Well, if your point of reference for truth is the Bible, then a set of scientific ideas that cover the same ground as the Bible will necessarily look confused. There's no way around it. If you start out with the Bible, you cannot accept Darwin's theory. And if you can't accept Darwin's theory, then whenever you see Darwin put together with anything else, it will look like, and let me coin a phrase here, hodgepodgery. It will necessarily look eclectic. The perspective that accepts the Bible as truth is uncompromising. And when you introduce one idea that doesn't match with the Bible, every other idea that it's connected to will, of course, fall apart. So it's not surprising at all that my work and my ideas look that way to someone whose point of reference is the Bible.
Do you find yourself controversial, Todd?
To some extent, yeah, there are a few web pages where people discuss my work, but most of the feedback I get is quite supportive. The idea of building a science of spirituality around Darwin's theory is something that is fairly new, and most people who believe in Darwin, who accept evolutionary biology as valid science, but at the same time have rich spiritual lives, are encountering it for the first time. And for the most part, they find it refreshing. What we're doing here in the time that we have now does indeed jump around a little bit. If we were taking any one of these ideas and going into it in depth, I'm pretty sure that it would look a lot more coherent. And what I have to say is, before you draw that conclusion, if you accept Darwinian evolution and science, and you believe that spirituality is a part of the human experience, then get my 509-page book, that includes the footnotes, from spiritualbrain.com. Pick Kindle, paperback, sit down, and read it.
Are you coming
out? The proof of the pudding is in the eating.
You're coming out with a second edition, aren't you?
There will be a second volume, yeah, and it will cover such things as subtle bodies, spiritual healing. There will be a few transcribed interviews, also some autobiographical material. When I was a child, I had temporal lobe epilepsy, and every seizure was a near-death experience. And I lived a life that demonstrated the personality traits of people with temporal lobe epilepsy, which includes a fixation on spirituality, or failing that, exotic ideas, a tendency to talk at length, which I know we've stumbled over once or twice so far tonight, and Well, I am what I am, and the early part of my autobiography, and that's kind of what that one chapter is really the story of my limbic system, the story of my brain. But I manifest personality traits that go with that kind of brain, and I had a number of experiences. I had out-of-body experiences several times a week when I was a child. I would find myself floating in an infinite black space with a tiny point of light on it, at the center of it, unimaginably far away, when my eyes were closed. When my eyes were open, everything around me looked like it was much larger than it actually was and much farther away, so that if you were sitting 10 feet from me and you were 6 feet tall, you would seem to be 600 feet away and 600 feet tall, with everything still having the same angle to my eye, but hugely exaggerated. And that experience, by the way, is known as macropsia. So when I got older and got involved in spirituality, I had a spiritual healer for a teacher, an Indian guru, a couple of Native American teachers. None of them spoke about these experiences. And when I saw Dr. Michael Persinger on TV eliciting one of these experiences through the God helmet, I said, yes, that's my career. So that's some autobiographical material. There's some other things. I don't spend much time in Volume 2, so it doesn't come to mind quickly. But there will be a great deal of more information. And I think the chapters on spiritual healing and how it happens is going to be well worth reading when the time comes. But in the meantime, they'll have to read Volume 1. At spiritualbrain.com, buy my book.
You are
read
a good self-promoter there, Tom.
Well, if I don't do it, who else will?
Me.
Okay. So let's take another question. We have a few more minutes.
Let's go to Scott, truck driving in Arizona. Scott, thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. My name is Scott. I'm out in truck driving in Arizona. I got a question.
Okay.
It goes hand-in-hand with the scientific aspect and the Bible. I believe in God, I believe the Bible, but I also believe that there could be aliens. I know that's a controversy right there. I'm an enigma. Rh negative blood. Your scientists cannot explain it. Do you have any theories on it? Because I do not believe that I came from a monkey. And my blood, AB negative, proves so. Rh stands for rhesus monkey. And I do believe that there's 85% of the population that has Rh positive blood, which is the rhesus monkey, and then the other 15% of us don't. And I'm in that 15%. And I never believed that I evolved from a monkey. Can you explain, or do you have any theories on that?
Well, I'm not an expert in blood typography or typology. But I do know that you started out saying that you believed in the Bible, and that is a point of faith that I wouldn't want to disturb. I don't believe in God the way most people do, but I believe in believing in God. So my answer to you, when all is said and done, must be, may God bless you.
Do you believe in extraterrestrial life, Todd?
As a behavioral neuroscientist, I consider that my opinion has no weight. That's a question for astronomers.
True.
So, and I'm not one. So, do I believe in it? I believe it's possible. Do I believe in all the reports of aliens? No. There are many people who have reported alien beings that were not. You know, the overwhelming majority of reports of aliens come from within people's own minds and their own brains. However, the question of whether intelligent life exists somewhere else than the Earth is separate from whether or not alien experiences are valid. So I'm going to say no to most, but not all alien experiences, not having the expertise to say no to all of them. And I'm going to say that if conditions on Earth created intelligent life here, there's absolutely no reason why similar conditions elsewhere might not produce intelligent life there. We send our technology out into space. There's no reason that another civilization somewhere else in the universe couldn't exist who also does the same thing. If we do it, why wouldn't someone else do it?
Todd, as we wrap things up, as you look at the direction that we're going as people, would you say there's hope, or there isn't?
I would say that there is hope, and I can turn your question into one that's a little more popular, and I've thought about it more, and that is the next directions for human evolution. And I believe that we are going to continue to evolve, but the evolution that we achieve from this point on has to be a matter of conscious choice. That is to say, we're going to be, our technology and our massive information overload, our medias are directing people to think and act in certain ways. And when we start making intelligent choices about what we will expose ourselves to, whether it's in the grocery stores or on the internet or on our television, we will begin to change. However, I don't believe that all of us will ever go along with the rest of us. There will always be people whose personality types are different enough, and we're probably never going to breed negativity out of our species, but we can learn to reward positivity, positive behavior, acts of compassion,
no doubt,
acts of mercy. We can reward them more and more in our classrooms, in our movies, in our conversations with one another, until it becomes more natural for people to be nice than it is for them to be nasty.
That's the way to do it. Todd, thank you so much. Sacred Pathways. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Latasseur, Stephanie Smith, Chris Burrows, George Knapp, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.